The Baseball Today podcast is presented by Travelocity. Travelocity's new top secret hotels makes Travelocity.com the best place for hotel deals.
This is Baseball Today.
First and foremost, I'm a baseball player.
Baseball was a funny game. It was a round ball that comes in a square box.
And then I ended up getting up and talking. I started to really get going, and I had to kind of cut myself off.
I know the fans are great. You know, this is where I wanted to be from day one.
Play ball!
Baseball Today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Baseball Today. It's Wednesday, April 21st, 2010. I am your humble servant, Eric Carabel. Behind the glass is Jay Soderberg. And a lot of you have written in and saying, I can't wait for Wednesday. Wednesday's my favorite podcast of the week. Now, why could that be? Why could Wednesday be their favorite? Oh, that's right. Wednesday is Mark Simon Day, the TMI writer and Baseball Tonight researcher. And we do have Mark with us right now. Mark, welcome to the show again. How do you feel that about people liking you more than pretty much anyone else on the show?
I have to admit, I'm a little embarrassed by it, but keep the notes coming. I'm happy to read them.
Well, they're legit. Yep. Honestly, I mean, I don't make up the emails.
Cool. All Neither
right.
do I.
Lots to get to on today's show. You even gave me some things you want to talk about.
Sure.
And, which is fine with me. And let's start out, and we'll combine this with something that happened on Tuesday, which bothered me greatly. Jason Hayward of the Braves, we know how good he is. He had a home run against Ryan Madsen, who shouldn't be a closer, and tied the game, and then, of course, Jose Contreras served one up in the 10th. But Jason Hayward, what do you got on him? I know you got some pretty intricate stats here and some comparisons. Let's see what you have.
Yeah, we started asking Elias after six, seven games, what's the most RBIs a player had in his first six or seven games? What's the most he's had in his first eight? And every time Hayward got an RBI, we just kept adding on. When you get to 13 games, most RBIs, first 13 career games for guys under the age of 21, two guys with 16. Jason Hayward's one, Ted Williams is the other. I just thought that was kind of cool. And if you look closer at the start of Ted Williams' career and you match it up with Jason's, Jason Hayward, so far in his career, 298, four home runs, 16 RBIs, 17 strikeouts, nine walks. Ted Williams, first 13 games, 286, four home runs, same as Hayward, 16 RBIs, same as Hayward, 14 strikeouts, almost as many as Hayward, four walks. Even Ted Williams had trouble making contact early in his career. That's kind of the point.
Now, do you think Jason Hayward is going to hit 406 ever and slug, what was it, 521 home runs,
I think it was? Well, let me say this, and this is not an original thought. I think it was Bill James or Joe Posnanski or someone that wrote this. If you look at guys that were given a shot at Jason Hayward's age to be outfielders on an everyday basis, if you look at the history of baseball, your list is essentially 16 guys. Here's half the list. Ted Williams, Willie Mays, Mickey Mantle, Frank Robinson, Ricky Henderson, Roberto Clemente, Ken Griffey Jr., Miguel Cabrera.
That's pretty good company,
That's
I would say.
That's kind of frightening. I mean, is it likely that he's going to be at that level? Who knows? But it's a reasonable expectation at this point to think that he's a special player based on that pedigree, essentially.
Wow, I was right. It was 521. That's yeah.
And what did he hit, like 340?
Let me see here. Yeah, career batting average was 344. Does it ever scare you, Mark, when you pull a number out of you-know-what,
yep,
and you're dead right? Because it scares me from time to time. Now, I love baseball more than any other sport, and I think you do too.
Yep.
But, like, every once in a while, I'll say, yeah, the score of that Phillies-Mets game when Von Hayes hit two homers was, 26-7 or
Correct.
Whatever. It was, wasn't it?
Yes.
And you know it, good Mets fan.
Yep.
And does it ever scare you?
It scares other people.
Okay.
I can tell you this. If you ever go into a social situation and you walk up to someone and say, hey, you want to hear the last 60 World Series winners and the teams that they beat? That kind of frightens people. I've been there. I've done that. Tim Kirkchin, same kind of thing. Tim likes to tell the story that he went to. He spoke at some baseball research convention, and something really ridiculous happened. It was like a one-in-a-million kind of occurrence. And Tim goes up to the first person he sees and says, did you hear about this one-in-a-million occurrence last night? I heard it was only the third or fourth time in the history of baseball. The guy says, yeah, I got the information right here in my pocket. So there are people like us, apparently, all over the place.
And we're not sick, people.
No.
We love baseball, and we remember what we want to remember.
Yep, and if you have a good memory, this is a good kind of job for you.
I would say so. Birthdays today. Jesse Roscoe, who must be really old since he was pitching when he was 50. 1957, so he's 53 today.
Yep.
Ronnie Polino, backup catcher. Jeff Kepinger, the only Houston Astros player. I looked this up the other day for a blog I wrote. Only Houston Astros hitter in the top 350 on the fantasy player rater was Jeff Kepinger. And he hadn't homered or stolen a base.
Well, you know what? That'll change because Berkman had two RBIs yesterday.
Well, yeah, but it's going to take him a little while to get that batting average, the enough at bats. Other birthdays, Kip Wells. Wow, what a career he's had. But and then Ken Caminiti, who won an MVP award. Tell me about Orozco, because I know you watch pretty much every game of his career.
Yeah.
What do you got on him? A good stat.
Let's see. I got three. Well, the obvious did you know on him is that he's the all-time leader in Major League games pitched. That's a record. That's an interesting one because it's a little over 1,200. And you look at the use of the reliever nowadays. The problem is, I mean, you got to average 60 games a year for 20 years to get to 1,200. So if David Weathers wants to come out of retirement, he's still essentially like 6 years from breaking Orozco's record. And David Weathers is essentially the closest thing he got to that. Jesse Orozco, first batter he ever retired in his career? Take a guess.
I'm Jamie Moyer. I don't know.
that would be pretty good. Bill Buckner.
Really?
Yes.
In 1979?
Correct, yeah. He got him out to end a 10-6 Mets win over the Cubs.
That's ironical.
It's kind of freaky. The other neat note on Orozco is if you look at the Barry Bonds hits to face list, Barry Bonds 4-for-28, 9 strikeouts career against Jesse Orozco.
Really?
2 home runs.
Lefty-lefty, but still, I mean, that's impressive.
Yep. You would hope that most fans are familiar with Jesse. He's the best guy born on the state, basically.
I'm looking now at the list of games played for pitchers. Orozco, 1252. Mike Stanton, second. I'm not sure I would have gotten that right. John Franco, Eckersley, Hoyt Wilhelm.
Kent Tecalvi.
I would have guessed Tecalvi.
Yeah.
And I would have guessed Lee Smith, and I probably would have guessed Joe Table.
Yep.
But and Mike Jackson, I actually would have guessed because he pitched in Philly.
Yep.
But Mike Stanton, I would have, and three lefties are the top three all time. John Franco, that's all. He was around a long time. All right. What else? You got anything? Oh, I want to talk about the Red Sox.
Sure.
The Red Sox had a big win on Tuesday, and it's an important win because, you know, people are going to panic in Boston and New York, and they came back to win a game that they probably shouldn't have won. But 7-6 victory, and I was amazed by the outfield. I mean, two of their starting outfielders are on the disabled list. So, of course, Darnell McDonald hits a home run, knocks on the winner. Jeremy Hermita hits a home run. What do you got on this Red Sox team now that it just seems odd what they're doing here? They're in panic mode, but should they be panicking?
Well, if you remember, on opening day, we eliminated the Cubs from having any chance to win the World Series this year because they gave up 16 runs, and no team that had ever given up 16 runs on opening day had won the World Series. We're going to eliminate the Red Sox from contention today. They started 4-9. They got the win yesterday to get to 5-9. No Red Sox team that started 4-9, and there's a decent number that started 4-9, 3-10, 2-11. You have to go back a little ways to find them. But none of those teams ever made the postseason, let alone won the World Series. So let's just eliminate the Red Sox right now.
You know what? If I was picking right now, look, I had the Yankees, the Red Sox, and the Rays.
Yep.
I believe in that order as my top three teams for the first power rankings. And now I would switch them. I mean, I would have the Rays and the Red Sox switch, which means the Red Sox wouldn't make the playoffs. But
yeah, the,
I still think they're going to win a lot of games, don't you?
The Rays, the four games, the Rays and the Red Sox looked like they were on different fields. I mean, the Rays were that
but
much
that's
better.
Happened before.
But it's not a good sign. The thing that, and Nomar actually brought this up that with regard to the defense, because the defense hasn't been good so far, it is so difficult to learn the Fenway infield with you have a new shortstop, a new third baseman, and it's so difficult because of the geography of the outfield to learn how to play the outfield. It seemed like he was saying it's incredibly unfair to judge off 13 games the defense of this team. They've made far many more misplays and errors than they did last season, but a little early to judge, and that would make you think that, you know, a couple of months from now they're going to be a little bit better. And you would figure that, just like last year, that Ortiz would wake up.
I still take the over on 90 wins, third place.
If I see this on May 1st, maybe I'm thinking a little differently. But if at this point, I'll say they're still in the 88 to 92 range.
The last time two teams with 100 wins were in the same division, you recall?
80 AL East?
Actually, I said it on, I asked that question pretty much on yesterday's show because I think now the Yankees and the Rays are both winning 100 games.
93 NL West.
It actually was more recent. Well, I haven't looked it up, but somebody wrote me and said, come on, Eric, what's the matter with you? The Seattle Mariners team that won 116. Apparently the Angels won 100 or Oakland did.
Stand by.
I'm going to look that up, too.
Let's investigate that as we
Because that seems realistic. Seattle won, what, like 116?
Well, 114? The Angels, we're talking, hang on, I think the Angels won 99 that year.
Oh, well, then maybe he was wrong. This is 2001. Yeah. So the AL West 2001. I mean, we're just thinking on the fly here, but somebody put that on my Facebook page, and I thought, yeah, he's right. Oakland won 102 that
year. There you go.
Okay. So that's the last time two teams won 100 games in the same division, and I think it's going to happen again this year with the Yankees and the Rays, which is pretty amazing.
For that to happen, you basically have to go 31-5 against Toronto and Baltimore, though. I think that's the position that Tampa's in. Yankees might win 110 this year. I think as long as no one seriously gets hurt, as long as Mariano's healthy, Yankees might get to 110.
I think it's definitely 100 for them, and I think the Rays are going to get there too. You know, as I was on this Ted Williams page, and I'm looking down at all his records of all time, obviously one of the greatest players of all time, offensive winning percentage.
Yep.
He's very close to Babe Ruth in offensive winning percentage. And in some other categories, maybe not adjusted OPS, I don't think he is as close. Tell everybody, because when we want to introduce a new stat on every show, I've been ripping RBIs, by the way, all week long. And people have been writing in to say, Eric, you're being too negative, like the old guy who used to be on the show, and we need to be some positive. Tell us what stats you do like. Tell me about offensive win percentage. Convince me that this is legit.
All right, I like this. It's almost out of its pure goofiness. What Bill James did, and this is about 25 years ago, was he said, what if you had a starting lineup that had nine of that player, that essentially had nine Ted Williams, that had nine Babe Ruths, and you made the presumption, and this is a very dangerous presumption, but you made it nonetheless, that everywhere that the clones played, they were essentially average defensive players. So you had an average defensive team, you had an average pitching team as well. How often would a lineup of nine Ted Williams win? And as you can see, if you go to his baseball reference page, 1941, they'd win 91% of the time. 1942, they'd win 89% of the time. 1946, they'd win 89% of the time. They basically never lose. And that's a way to measure, essentially, who's the best offensive player in baseball. And just to read through this year's leaders, Vernon Wells is 1, 905. Chase Utley is 2, 897. Nelson Cruz is 3, 886. And I like this, Casey McGee is 4th, 884. And it measures essentially, in factoring that in, it looks at runs created, which I'm going to presume some people know about, but runs created is essentially smushing together all your offensive contributions and coming up with a number that is essentially the number of runs that you're responsible for.
So this is runs created, not runs created per nine innings.
Yeah, that's runs created. Then you factor that into runs created per nine innings, and you figure that someone like, let's say, an elite player is an 8 runs per 27 outs guy. So if you typically average 8 and your opponent typically averages 4, that's how it comes out that you're going to win 90% of the time.
By the way, the top 5 active players in offensive win percentage might be interesting to some people. Albert Pujols is 10th overall all time.
Yep.
Todd Helton is 19th. Yep. I mean, he's had some monster numbers, and that's even Coors Field, you know, taking that out of the equation, which I don't know. Does offensive win percentage take out ballparks?
I think you can. I don't know
I don't
that the version
does.
That we're looking at
right.
does.
Manny Ramirez is 39th, Lance Berkman is 42, and Chipper Jones, 54, right, just ahead of Jim Thome.
Let me say this. There are a lot of people that don't like this one. I think it's kind of funny if you were like someone that was like a Stratomatic player or a computer baseball game player, and you were like, all right, let me just keep letting the same guy bat over and over again. Let's see how he does. It's kind of cheating, and it's a hypothetical because you'd never play essentially nine clones on a baseball field. But to me, it's just kind of a funny stat that allows you to measure a player's value offensively.
Now, who would ever play those games?
People like us.
Okay.
People that memorize statistics.
People who are smart and crazy and love baseball. Let's move it along. We'll get to some emails later with you. It's Around the Diamond time now.
News from around the league.
Let's go Around the Diamond.
All right, there is some news to get to today, and the Reds' Edinson Volquez was banned 50 games after failing a test. I don't know what the exact terminology is or what he took, but what I don't understand out of this, Mark, and I know you haven't prepped for this or anything, but I want to know why. If a guy gets suspended, like Cliff Lee had his suspension rescinded as well. Now, Cliff Lee's on the disabled list, but he could not serve that five-game suspension if it wasn't rescinded while on the DL. How come Edinson Volquez can serve his 50-game suspension while he's on the disabled? He's out half the season at least after having shoulder surgery. I don't understand that, do you?
Yeah, that's a loophole.
That's a loophole. That is in the bargaining agreement.
That's one they got to close the next time around, because I have nothing more to say on that other than that doesn't seem right.
It doesn't seem right to me either. But anyway, Volquez wasn't going to pitch until probably July or August for the Reds, and this actually doesn't even harm him at all.
Even Arroyo, Brunson Arroyo quote from the AP story, I'm actually surprised they're letting him do that, which is that they're letting him, he can serve the suspension while essentially continuing his rehab at their spring training complex in Arizona.
That seems awfully odd to me, and you know, I don't have a better answer on it either. It just seems wrong.
I would be shocked if that loophole wasn't closed.
I agree with that. Cliff Lee, meanwhile, had his five-game suspension for throwing at but not hitting. I believe it was Chris Snyder of the Diamondbacks back in spring training. Now, I don't understand why that was rescinded in the first place either. It doesn't make much sense to me. Well, from what I hear, and I saw it on SportsCenter, I think with Buster, was that basically his agent said, well, he was hurt, his foot was hurt, his arm wasn't right, he wasn't aiming at him, and he convinced the geniuses of baseball to rescind the suspension. He would have had to serve that after his DL stint. He'll probably be back the first week of May, and this isn't that big a deal either, but I just find it kind of odd. Why suspend him in the first place? Because it's a reset. I thought maybe you can't go from 5 games to 3 because it wouldn't affect him.
Right.
But because he's a starter every 5 days, but there's something wrong with that.
They haven't come up yet with an effective way to suspend a starting pitcher. I mean, if we've been around for 100-something years, and they've been doing the same thing, essentially, over and over, that essentially a position player is almost punished sometimes for being a position player, whereas a pitcher, they'll get the suspension cut. You know, and a lot of suspensions do get cut after the appeal, but it's like it doesn't make sense. It's almost like you should say, "All right, you should be forced to designate him for a start, and then he gets suspended for that start, and then you designate him for his next start, he gets suspended for that, and essentially to legitimize the process."
Some bad news out of Colorado, or actually where he was in Salt Lake City. Colorado Rockies president Kelly McGregor, who I wasn't aware had played in the NFL before becoming into the baseball business of being into management, found dead at the age of 48 of apparent natural causes. Our best our condolences to the Rockies family and of course McGregor's family. He had 4 children, which that's when I saw that I was like, oh.
Terrible story.
Terrible news there. Let's focus on some other stuff here. Angels put Jeff Mathis on the 15-day DL. Now, I know a lot of people in the fantasy world who have Mike Napoli and couldn't understand why he had 9 at-bats through the first 3 weeks of the season. Well, you're going to get your wish now. Napoli's going to play every day. But Mathis was playing really well, and he's a superior defender. So I'm not so sure. This does not help the Angels, that's for sure. They recall Rob Quinlan from the minors. I don't know if you had noticed that Jeff Mathis was playing pretty much every day, and Napoli, who had 20 home runs each of the last 2 seasons, wasn't. Just seemed odd to me, but now it kind of fixes itself.
Every problem tends to have its own solution at an early point in the season when you look at why a guy's not getting at-bats. It's funny to me how teams complain about, you'll hear complaints, oh, my team has 4 outfielders and they're never going to be able to play this guy. Guys get hurt. It's inevitable. Half of baseball winds up on the DL every year. These things tend to work themselves out. He'll get his chance to play. I think he fell out of favor a little bit because of his defense.
Yeah, I think it was his defense, too. You know, and you say that, like the Red Sox are the prime example of a team that has so many starting pitchers that at some point, I don't know how Daisuke Matsuzaka is going to start. Tim Wakefield got lit up yesterday, so it's possible that maybe Wakefield all of a sudden has an injury we don't know about or goes to the bullpen. But the Red Sox have bigger problems in their outfield. Cameron and Ellsbury both on the disabled list. And I was on TV today, and somebody said, I don't know anything about Darnell McDonald. Now, I know something about Darnell McDonald because, you know, I've been following this stuff for years, but he's not somebody that the Red Sox fans would want to see playing every day. I want to make that clear. But, you know, for one day, big hits, home runs, You know, I would prefer, I think Jeremy Hermida is somebody who should be playing every day. McDonald with 69 career games over four seasons. I remember him as a Red last year, and he didn't hit a whole lot, but minor league numbers look pretty good.
Yeah, well, the thing that would scare you from last year, 31 strikeouts, 5 walks, and 105 at-bats.
Not the most patient hitter.
No, but hey, if you look now in Red Sox history, he's kind of a guy that you'll always remember. Let's say he never does anything again. They had a guy in 67, the impossible dream season. His major league debut, this is Bill Rohr, 8 1/3 no-hit innings against the Yankees. That's pretty good. And Red Sox fans, just another one. This one's for my boss because he loves referencing this game. In 89 or 90, they were going down to the wire with the Blue Jays to try and win the division when you only had only one team got in, no wild card. They had Jeff Stone, who you'll know as a former Philly. Jeff Stone, I think, had one at-bat, or if not one at-bat, he had one hit for the Red Sox. It was essentially a walk-off hit in the biggest game of the season by far, and essentially in Red Sox country, he is a revered figure because he was essentially the perfect guy.
Jeff Stone in 1990 went 1-for-2.
Yep, there you go.
And scored a run. Batted 500. The other at-bat was a strikeout. He had a caught stealing an RBI. And, man, when he was the Phillies, might have been the fastest man I've ever seen, but not, well, I want to say, be careful how I say this. Not a very good baseball player.
He had some issues.
He had some issues, and he was a horrible base runner for being that fast.
Yep.
He used to fall down all the time. He and Lonnie Smith would just fall down for no reason. And
yeah, that's why they called Smith Skates.
Skates, right. And I don't remember what Stone's nickname was, but he just was not a good player.
Yeah, can I give you a piece of, I guess, what is breaking news?
Sure, it's your show, too.
Pitch this morning. 5 innings, looks like no runs, 1 hit, 68 pitches, 6 strikeouts, 1 walk. He was pitching with Harrisburg leading Reading 1-0, and Harrisburg wound up winning the game, so Strasburg is now 2-0.
What's your over-under when he comes up?
What's that?
When do you think he comes up to the majors?
10 starts this year, so maybe it's all-star break.
You think he's only going to make 10 starts for the Nationals?
If he's 7-0 with like a sub-1 ERA, they're going to have to call him up.
But they have to wait at least until like mid-May, I think, for financial reasons.
I think that definitely plays a role. 68 pitches, 48 strikes.
Look, he's way too good for Double A.
Yep.
That's it for the news of the day, including our breaking news. Now we've got the call to the pen.
Call to the pen. You've got email.
And you can send those emails to baseballtoday@espnradio.com. Jay Soderberg looks at them, gives me a couple. I read them. Today we're going to read a couple to Mark. This is Brian, who says he's an everyday loyal listener. Parts unknown. How much does a team need hits from the number 2 spot in the batting order as opposed to just on base percentage? I'm particularly thinking about the number 2 hitter because while a walk will move the leadoff man to second, a hit might put him on third or score him if he's already stolen second. My hunch is that a number 2 hitter who has a great on base percentage but hits for poor percentage will only last for so long because eventually the manager will need a guy who hits and thus has potential to move a leadoff runner 2 bags instead of 1. I could be wrong. Have we ever seen a number 2 hitter stay in the order hitting 215 as long as his on base is 400? I can tell you one guy doing it right now is Nick Johnson, and he ain't going anywhere. My take on this would be on base percentage is just as good as batting average, more important actually.
Yeah, I would say you want to 215 400 is an incredibly rare combination. If you look at guys for a full season, so I that question has to be about Johnson Stewart this year. I think what you're looking for out of a number 2 hitter is a guy who has the ability to take a strike, fall behind in the count, and then make the adjustment in the at bat to try and get a hit. There aren't that many. If you look at last year's stats, there are a lot of very good average number 2 hitters, and most of the good average number 2 hitters are pretty good on base percentage guys too. Miguel Tejada being the exception. My number 1 skill in a number 2 hitter would be ability to take a pitch, allow a guy to steal a base, and then the ability to put the ball into play. Essentially, if you get the runner into scoring position, at the very least, you want to advance the base.
I don't think personally that Joe Girardi cares if Nick Johnson bats 146 as long as his on base percentage is over 400.
Yeah, as long as he doesn't hit into 50 double plays.
Right, which he's only hit into 1 so far.
Yeah.
I would like to see a stat on this, and I would write a column about it at some point. Last guy to have an on base over 400 and hit below 200. Yeah, does that ever happen?
I actually looked, and I don't have
Eddie
it on my
Yost
screen
ever
anymore. I was looking for lowest batting average guy played full season on base of 400. I think it was Wes Westrum, 1951 Giants, which is kind of ridiculous. McGuire, I think, had some real weird ones where he was like 190, 340. Wes Westrum, here you go, 1951 Giants catcher, 219 batting average with 104 walks. So he had an on-base of 400.
Wow.
That's crazy.
It's been a long time.
Yeah, that's almost 60 years.
I'm looking up McGuire now, and I don't see his last year, 187 batting average, but a 316 on base.
Yeah, so he was able to push it like 100, 120 points.
But this is tough. What Nick Johnson is doing is unbelievable. And I don't know, I guess he could be moved out at some point, because they do have Brett Gardner, who looks like he's ready to bat first or second.
Yeah.
And they can move Jeter to two.
Who's the best two-hitter in baseball? I mean, there's last year, if you look at the way it played out, I mean, Crawford was pretty awesome.
I mean, I'll tell you what. I think Martin Prado, who is basically Polanco,
yep.
Those guys are going to hit. Those guys could win batting titles this year.
Yep.
Prado and Polanco, they don't walk. They don't strike out.
Yep.
They take pitches. They can take 3-2 pitch and let the leadoff batter steal.
Yep.
Nate McLouth is in a wonderful situation if he could just hit 250.
Yep.
He could steal 30 bases with Prado batting second.
And I would put Crawford up there, too, just for all around.
Of course. I mean, there's some great number two hitters in baseball. I mean, Aaron Hill last year had 36 homers batting second, didn't he?
Sure.
All right. Moving on. This is Alex in Toronto. Hi, guys. Love the show. Thanks for keeping me company on the train ride home for the last few seasons. I've been especially loving the episodes with your guest, Mark Simon. Alex, he's more than a guest. He's here every Wednesday. He's not leaving. I heard that a guest would be leaving, but you're not. You're like a co-host now.
I appreciate that.
You're great. I heard that this is the first year that most of the ballparks have the equipment required to collect pitch FX data. What information is in this data? How can it be used? And can you foresee it having any effect in how games and teams are managed? FX data, what is that?
Sure. It's actually the third year that every park has it. I have to admit, you gave me the question in advance, so I took a closer look. PitchFX data, it's essentially a computer system, for those unfamiliar, that's in every major league ballpark. It was done by the guys that did the glowing puck, Sport Vision. There are two cameras in every ballpark that are focused on specific spots, and what they do is they read every pitch that's thrown, and they can, based on the certain qualifiers that a pitch has, like they'll see the pitch's speed is upwards of 90 miles per hour, so they'll know it's a fastball. If they see a pitch that's less than 90 miles an hour, they'll look at the break, and if the pitch has a real sharp break, they'll say it's a slider, or they'll say it's a curveball. If there are certain patterns of movement to every pitch, so you can identify every pitch that's thrown. You can also identify where the pitch goes. There are a couple of neat applications for this that you'll see. We've kind of worked them into Baseball Tonight. You might have heard last year, we would, in That's Nasty, Adam Wainwright would throw a curveball, and we'd say, wow, 17 inches of break. So you can evaluate how sharp of a break you get on a breaking pitch with that camera system. The other thing that's kind of neat, and it's a little scary, someone did an article on the Hartball Times, and I'd recommend to anyone that they check this out, where they were able to determine essentially what the strike zone really looks like for every count. How essentially a strike zone with two strikes is a lot different from a strike zone with one strike. Based on every pitch, they can tell you where it was within the strike zone. That's what this system can do. So, for example, with two strikes, the strike zone essentially is not the big rectangle. It's essentially a smaller circular kind of shape. That kind of looks like, I guess you would call it like an amoeba, because studies have found, and this was presented at MIT at the what people are calling the Dorkapalooza convention, the sports statistics convention at MIT a couple of weeks ago. Studies have found that with two strikes, the umpire is not as likely to call strike three if the hitter takes the pitch in the strike zone as he would if strike one was in the same spot. He'll call strike one, but he won't call strike three. And the study showed that the umpire and officials in general don't want to commit an act where they're essentially ending an at-bat. They want the hitter to end the at-bat rather than take. I realize that's a little bit of a convoluted explanation. Hopefully you grasped it. The other neat thing, and it's coming soon, it's probably 3-4 years down the road, is FieldFX, which is an offshoot of this, where they're going to be able to tell you essentially how many steps a guy took to get to a ball, what Derek Jeter did in terms of trying to field balls that were hit 5 feet to his right at 40 miles an hour. There's a lot of neat things that are going to be able to be done with this. I would just say punch it into Google and see what you get, and I think you'll find a lot of interesting things.
I think so. And by the way, I am a regular visitor to that website, Hardball Times, as well. Yep. I'm on Baseball Reference all the time. I mean, there's some great baseball writing out there.
Yep.
That people can find.
The thing about the strike zones was incredible, though. And the guy had essentially an image of every count, what the strike zone really looks like based on the PitchFX data. Now, in fairness, it's not perfect. It misses. There were a couple of pitches last year where, like, Bobby Parnell threw a pitch that they clocked on TV at 99 or 100. His typical during the year was 94, 95. I think it blew out the system because the camera didn't get it. So every so often it'll miss a pitch. Their accuracy has generally been about 95% at getting pitches. They're trying to up that to 98, 99, 100%. It takes time. It's not a perfect system. Sometimes, too, it'll misidentify a pitch. Like, I guess, again, using a Met example, it might not know that Mike Pelfrey throws the splitter at this point and is still trying to figure out his pattern.
Do you know why Pelfrey's pitching so much better?
Well, the splitter.
It's because of the splitter, all right? I mean,
yeah,
that's it.
It's been... I looked it up earlier today, actually. I did a little post for the blog on ESPN New York. He even said it last night. He said, the splitter's working wonders for me right now. Basically, he can throw the splitter low and away, and the hitter can't touch it. He's thrown 10, so I think it was, he's thrown 13 so far that were low and away. He's gotten strikes almost every time, and no one's gotten a hit on it yet. That's just to the spot that's low and away. The problem with Pelfrey the last couple of years is he's so easily predictable. He threw as many fastballs, he threw fastballs as often as anyone in baseball. Every pitch essentially was the same pitch. It was a fastball. If he could locate it well, he was all right. But if he missed on location, he was terrible. This year he's got the splitter, so he's throwing the fastball less, he's throwing the splitter more, and he's throwing his other pitches and mixing them in, and it's like a completely new world for him, especially at Citi Field where it's tough to score runs to begin with.
And on next week's show, you'll tell us the last guy to lead his team in wins and saves. Right now, Pelfrey is the only Met with a save from that ridiculous 20-inning game.
Well, I think we can tell you now, three wins and a save, first six wins of the season. Yeah, here we go. Three wins in save, pitcher's first four games of season. This comes from Elias. Does not come from me.
This is unbelievable.
Hector Carrasco.
You're kidding me.
Hector Carrasco, 1994 Reds, had three wins and a save in his first four appearances of the season. Before him, Lamar Hoyt, 1981. White Sox.
Okay, you're out there.
Right, well, hang on a second. That one doesn't come from me. That comes from the Elias Sports Bureau.
We'll give them
right
full credit.
Wait till you hear my Eckstein note. I want to get to that one.
All right, well, tell me. What right. David Eckstein hit a walk-off home run on Monday night for the Padres.
Yep, he also hit a web gym last night. That was pretty good.
Tell me about David Eckstein.
All right, David Eckstein hit a walk-off home run on Monday night for the Padres. That gave David Eckstein 35 career home runs. This was pure luck, fluke, total joke that I even was able to find this. Joe Morgan, whatever you think of him, best little guy player of all time. I don't think anyone can dispute that. Hall of Famer, megastar, two MVPs in a row, big red machine, all that. Joe Morgan retired, what was it, 1984, 1985. So if you look at the little guy in baseball from that point on, the little guy in baseball has kind of essentially become a dinosaur. There are no good little guy players. Warren Newson hit 34 career home runs. His career began after Joe Morgan retired. Yesterday, David Eckstein hit his 35th, Monday rather, David Eckstein hit his 35th career home run. He essentially broke the Warren Newson record for most home runs by a guy who's 5'7" or smaller in the post-Joe Morgan era. Does that make sense?
I'm flabbergasted.
Basically, it's essentially you have to draw a dividing line, and the dividing line is where Joe Morgan retired. The little guy was taken out of baseball at that point because, well, let's be honest, you know, people are favoring big, power, strong hitters who are hitting home runs. Little guy's a dinosaur. Very hard to appreciate the little guy. Since Joe Morgan retired, David Eckstein is now essentially, you could argue, the best little guy of all time.
How do you define little guy?
I think we went with 5'7" or smaller.
Okay, 5'7" or
smaller. And in fairness, we never, you know, tights are very, who knows.
Sure.
But I just thought that was kind of cool.
It's very cool and hard to believe.
It's kind of goofy, but I mean, the guy, every time the guy has three walk-off home runs, and I don't remember the notes that are attached to the other two, but every David Eckstein walk-off home run has some sort of great note attached to it. That one was just luck, but I know that there's a lot of dispute, you know, greedy player versus quality player. I like watching David Eckstein.
I love watching David Eckstein. I think he's great.
Yep.
And I know something that I never knew before.
Yeah, it's kind of 35 home runs, most by a little guy in the post-Joe Morgan era.
If I have the same size and weight as Joe Morgan, is that a good thing or a bad thing? 5'7", 160.
Well, one's for all the little guys that are fans that couldn't play.
There you go.
David Eckstein is their hero.
King. All right, in the we're going to move on now, sure. The longest show ever. Baseball Today, ESPNRadio.com. Get your emails in, people. I'll get to whatever I can on Thursday. Now it's time for our final segment of the show, which is called The View from Third.
Almost home.
Taking a look at tonight's matchups.
This is The View from Third.
And it's a shame because I have this email here from our friend of the show who loves the Braves, which I'll get to on Thursday's show. And it'll actually give me some time to think about the question, so we'll do that.
Yeah, he wants to know if Halliday's going to win tonight. Is that the one?
Something like that.
Yeah.
He better. Halliday on the mound against the Braves on ESPN at 7:10 p.m. Eastern Time against Tim Hudson. It's a worthy opponent. Tim Hudson off to a very good start as well and had a lot of strikeouts in the spring, and Halliday is dominant. I'll just say this about Halliday. He better finish it because... No Phillies fan wants to see Ryan Madsen, Dennis Baez, or Chad Durbin coming out of the bullpen.
Yeah, especially after last night. And that's what Halliday does. If you can go back, doesn't matter whether you go back 3 years, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, Halliday has more complete games than, like, teams do. He is the most among active pitchers. He got his 50th, I think it was two starts ago. He's the best in the – he's the one guy that you see now that you could say, boy, he would have been a good fit 40 years ago.
If Halliday is at 100 pitches in the sixth inning, Phillies have a problem.
Yep. Well, hey, didn't you Baldo Jimenez? Wasn't he at like 100 pitches in the sixth inning?
Yeah, but if he had allowed two hits and a run, they would have taken him out.
Yeah.
Like CeCe Sabathia, that you know, Girardi says he would have taken him out even with that no hitter. How can you do that? And actually, I saw Bobby Valentine on Baseball Tonight talking about it. And he's like, he said I took Nolan Ryan out with a no hitter in the seventh inning once, and he glared at me, and that was it.
Yeah, and then Tony La Russa brought in an outfielder to pitch and put in a pitcher to play the outfield.
By the way, I had so many rants on that the last 2 days, but we're in overtime on this show. Is there anything else happening on Wednesday? I'm going to look here to pitching matchups.
Carlos Silva, I would keep an eye on how well he pitches.
Are you buying Silva and Oliver Perez, for that matter?
Not yet, no. But, short answer.
But Silva is a guy who induces grounders, doesn't walk anybody, doesn't hurt himself. Oliver Perez is a walker. I would trust Silva over Perez.
Yeah, I would be inclined to do that as well. They both have big contracts. They both have not lived up to them, and I don't know that they ever will.
Chris Carpenter against Edwin Jackson, they have the same ERA. I imagine this will be the last time all season that happens. 3.50 ERA. Carpenter's terrific. He just has to avoid the home runs. Phil Hughes for the Yankees against Ben Sheets. That's a really good pitching matchup there. And Sheets has a 2.65 ERA, and you say, wow, he's pitching great. WHIP of 1.71. Be careful, people. Ben Sheets is not pitching all that well.
Yeah, well, I would be careful, especially tonight.
And the latest Francisco Liriano episode against Cleveland and Huff. Huff off to a good start as well. Liriano with a 2.08 ERA. Can Liriano be a Cy Young winner? Can he be that good again?
Oh, boy. I don't know that I'm necessarily qualified to answer that. I think he's on the right track. I think that's a fair answer at this point. And he's facing Cleveland tonight, so you figure...
It's not a good offensive team.
He's going to be 2-0 by the time the night's out.
Okay, there's your prediction sure to go wrong. No.
Sure.
Liriano should be pretty good this season. All right, that seems like it's just about it for today's show. Obviously, 15 games on the slate on Wednesday. Phillies, Braves, Halliday, Hudson. Watch it on ESPN later tonight. I want to thank Mark Simon. You do a great job, Mark. Thanks for joining us here on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, that's a wrap for today. For Jay Soderberg behind the glass, who's glaring at me because we went into overtime, I am Eric Carabell. Thanks to Mark Simon. Get your emails in. I'll be back on Thursday. Adios.
Thanks for listening to Baseball Today. For more baseball talk, be sure to check out Baseball Tonight, Monday through Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern on ESPN Radio and ESPNRadio.com.
Yeah, that's what we've been looking for.